Good afternoon. It's Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review, and it's Wednesday, April 24th. We'll start as usual with the front page. From Brendan Moore, Macon County Democrats. Brian Smith elected new party chair. Smith received nearly 60% of weighted vote. Macon County Democrats voted on Monday to elect former county board member Brian Smith the new party chair. Smith received nearly 60% of the weighted vote of the county's Democratic precinct committeemen. Second place finisher Shadavian Goforth, who sits on the executive board of IBEW Local 51, was subsequently elected party vice chair. Tiffany Hall, the Democratic nominee for coroner, came in third place. Carl Coleman, who had served as party chair since 2021, did not seek re-election. He did not return a request for comment. Smith has spent his entire adult life in and around local government and politics. In 85, at the age of 19, he was elected Long Creek Township Clerk. In 92, he began a four-year stint as Township Supervisor. He later served for 18 years on the Macon County Board until losing his re-election bid in 2020. He returned for another four-year stint as Township Clerk in 2019. Professionally, he was Executive Director of the Township Officials of Illinois for more than 25 years until he retired in 21. He is also the Chair of the Long Creek Township Democrats. I wanted to be more involved because I felt the party could grow, Smith, 58, told Herald and Review. I felt the party was kind of at a standstill. There were some factions, and I felt like I would be able to bring folks together to work together for our common goal, which is electing Democrats. Macon County Democrats have fallen on hard times. In 2020, then-President Donald Trump secured nearly 58% of the Macon County vote, the highest vote share for a Republican presidential candidate in the county since Richard Nixon's 72 landslide win over George McGovern. The Democrats' slide has continued in the years since. In 22, the party went from being in the minority, 13-8, to 12-3 on the Macon County Board. This came after the enactment of a Republican gerrymandered map that reduced the body's size and packed Democratic voters into one three-person district. Only two of nine countywide elected officials are Democrats. While part of this is due to larger political trends, some of it was the party's own doing. In 22, three candidates nominated to run for clerk, sheriff, and treasurer as Democrats withdrew after local Republicans alleged that their nominating petitions were not properly notarized. The slated candidates declined to fight the allegations in court, thus allowing Republican candidates to run unopposed in the general election. This year, no Democrats ran in the primary for state's attorney, circuit clerk, or auditor. Smith acknowledged that his task of turning around the party won't be easy and won't happen overnight, but he said it starts with a bottom-up approach that emphasizes door-knocking, bringing more people into the party fold, and raising more campaign cash. I think a lot of it is just not working hard enough, Smith said of the local party's recent struggles. As precinct committeemen, our jobs are to get out there and find out what our neighbors are feeling on certain things, knock on those doors and let people know that the Democrats and the Democratic Party have their backs. Smith said that his background in township government will be an asset when it comes to party building. Townships often serve as the unofficial farm teams for political parties. They are often the first elected office a person holds and can serve as a springboard to the state legislature, county board, and countywide elected offices. He said leading the state's preeminent township association gives him experience leading a diverse group of people. I had some townships in this state that have a population of over 200,000, and then I had some that had a population of less than 30, Smith said. And those township officials that represented those areas were very diverse. And so I felt I had a lot of experience leading an organization of diverse individuals, but they're united around a common goal. Smith did not say whether the party would nominate candidates to fill empty positions on the November ballot, saying that we will be discussing that at their next meeting. Prospective candidates would need to be nominated by the party and submit the requisite number of nominating petition signatures by early June. Smith lives in Long Creek and is a single father of two adult children. Continuing with the front page from Donette Beckett, Indicator, Power of the Sun. Solar panels brighten up Unity Christian School. And we have a photograph of Richard Anderson, founder and COO of CQI Associates, cutting a piece of ribbon for sixth graders. Clementine Houston, Brynna Conley, and Myra Tanta after an unveiling ceremony for the Unity Christian School Solar Array in Decatur on Tuesday. The students at Unity Christian School have a living classroom between the baseball and football fields. Students and staff of Unity Christian School unveiled their solar panel project to the community Tuesday afternoon, the day after Earth Day. Situated on the school campus between two athletic fields, the state-of-the-art solar array is a reminder of the power of solar energy and its benefits to our community, the school stated in a news release. A heavy rain kept the students and staff inside the gymnasium for a ribbon-cutting ceremony. However, a group of sixth graders were able to tour the project months ago while it was still in the construction phase. "The sun shines on the solar panel and energy from the sunlight is absorbed," said student Myra Tanta. "And this energy creates electrical charges that move in response to an internal electrical field in the cell, causing electricity to flow." The students have had an interest in the solar array before it was placed on the 54-acre Unity Christian School campus. "I used to be obsessed with saving the planet," said Clementine Houston before the ribbon-cutting ceremony. The students had their own questions as the solar panels were being installed. "I was wondering what would happen if somebody was at the baseball field," Brynna Conley said, "about a potential home run hit." The school's executive, Brian Booth, had an answer. "It shouldn't be too close to the baseball field," he said. "They set it back enough, unless someone just hit an amazing, powerful home run, it shouldn't break one of them." CQI Associates developed the project. Straight Up Solar installed the panels. Standard Solar owns and operates the solar module. The 2,028 panels, covering 3 acres, generate 912 kilowatts of energy. The array will produce 98% of the power for the school. It was constructed so it doesn't cause any problems with the sports facilities or school's activities. The children will be able to study the solar array throughout the year. Since the project's been installed, they have been monitoring all of the output and what the array is producing, said Mary Joint, Standard Solar Public Relations. They are very involved. Representing Straight Up Solar for the project, Shannon Fulton said the company has installed solar panels in other areas of central Illinois. "But this is a good-sized project," she said. "It's not an uncommon size project, especially for a small school district. This will make a big dent in their energy bills." The solar panels are an ideal opportunity to educate this community as well as the students in clean energy, the company said. "They're putting assets into the community that actually benefit the kids' future and the community's future," Fulton said. The sixth graders said they were excited about the possibilities the solar array will do for their school as well. "It's a nice renewable energy source," Clementine said, "and more schools should change to it. This is so much better than all the other ways to make energy," Myra said. "And it's better for our bills," added Brynna. We also have a photograph of overhead of the Unity Christian School's solar array. It was taken by a drone on August 26th of 23. From the Environment column, Jennifer McDermott, Associated Press. Plastic treaty talks hit at critical stage. Thousands of negotiators and observers representing most of the world's nations gathered in the Canadian city of Ottawa on Tuesday to craft a treaty to stop the rapidly escalating problem of plastic pollution. Each day, the equivalent of 2,000 garbage trucks full of plastic are dumped into the world's oceans, rivers, and lakes, according to the United Nations Environment Program. People are increasingly breathing, eating, and drinking tiny plastic particles. Negotiators must streamline the existing treaty draft and decide its scope, whether it will focus on human health and the environment, limit the actual production of plastic, restrict some chemicals used in plastics, or any combination of the above. These are elements that a self-named high-ambition coalition of countries want to see. Alternatively, the agreement could have a more limited scope and focus on plastic waste and greater recycling, as some of the plastic producing and oil and gas exporters want. In March 22, 175 nations agreed to make the first legally binding treaty on plastics pollution, including in the oceans, by the end of 24. It's an extremely short timeline for negotiations meant to match the urgency of the problem. This is the fourth of five meetings of the United Nations Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee for Plastics. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to fix something everyone knows needs to be fixed because plastic in the environment is not natural, said Inger Andersen, UNEP's executive director. People globally are disgusted by what they see. The straw in the turtle's nose, the whale full of fishing gear. I mean, this is not the world we want to be in, she said in an interview. Andersen rejected the idea it's an anti-plastic process because plastic has many uses that help the world. But, she said, the treaty should eliminate unnecessary single-use and short-lived plastic products that often are buried, burned, or dumped. Plastic production continues to ramp up globally and is projected to double or triple by 2050 if nothing changes. Researchers at the Federal Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory published a report last week examining the climate impact. If production grows conservatively, greenhouse gas emissions emitted from the process would more than double, they concluded. That could use 21 to 26% of the remaining so-called global carbon budget, which is how much carbon emissions can still be produced between now and 2050, while staying at or below the international goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius since the 1850s. Most plastic is made from fossil fuels. Negotiators at the United Nations climate talks, known as COP28, agreed last December the world must transition away from planet-warming fossil fuels and triple the use of renewable energy. But as pressure to reduce fossil fuels increased, oil and gas companies have been looking more to the plastic side of their business as a lifeboat, a market that could grow. The largest challenge for the negotiations is that major oil and gas producing countries do not want a treaty that limits their ability to extract and export fossil fuels to make plastic, said Bjorn Bieler, international coordinator for the International Pollutants Elimination Network. IPEN wants a treaty that places global controls on hazardous chemicals in plastics and ends the rapid growth of plastic production. Production is at the center of everything. It's the reason why this is moving slow. And it's going to get supercharged, he said. It's not about oceans, it's more about oil. U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon is leading a congressional delegation to Ottawa to advocate for a strong treaty. The U.S. government position so far is that nations should take voluntary steps to end plastic pollution, but that is not enough to drive change, Merkley said. The underlying reason why the U.S. is not ambitious is we are a fossil gas country, he said. Chris John, president and CEO of the American Chemistry Council, the Industry Trade Association, said the focus should be on eliminating plastic pollution without eliminating the benefits of plastic. When treaty talks began in Uruguay in December 22, factions quickly came into focus. Some countries pressed for global mandates, some for voluntary national solutions, and others for both. Progress was slow during Paris talks in May 23 and in Nairobi in November, but there's still enough time to advance an ambitious treaty, said Alexis Jackson, who will lead a delegation from the Nature Conservancy in Ottawa. The Nature Conservancy, Greenpeace, and other environmental advocates believe the treaty must reduce the amount of plastic that is produced and used in order to end plastic pollution. We're more than halfway through the process now, so we have an undeniably large amount of work to do, Jackson said. But I think that we can make change happen even when it is difficult. Andersen at the United Nations also is optimistic that there will be a meaningful treaty this fall at the final meeting in South Korea. And now from local and state news. Assumption to host French Heritage Celebration. From Donette Beckett in Assumption. French Heritage Celebration will be from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday, April 27th. In the Assumption downtown area. Admission into the event is free. The festival is designed to provide a historical look at Assumption and the French settlers who built the community. Activities include a quilt show, antique gun show, Assumption history display, scavenger hunt, and food vendors. Local restaurants will also be open. Entertainment will be provided by Dennis Stromat and the Creole Stomp Band, playing authentic Zydeco music from 5 to 8 p.m. at 1905 Brewery. The event is sponsored by the Assumption Community Pride Association, the Assumption Women's Club, and the Assumption Historical Society. From DeKalb County, Kate Armanini, and the Chicago Tribune. Illinois now home to federally recognized tribal nation. Illinois is now home to a federally recognized tribal nation after the U.S. Department of the Interior placed portions of the Chabanais Reservation into trust, according to a statement Friday from the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. The federal government illegally auctioned off 1,280 acres of the Prairie Band's reservation land 175 years ago, the nation said. At the time, Chief Chabanais had been traveling from his home reservation in DeKalb County to visit his family in Kansas. We have been asking for this recognition and for what is rightfully ours for nearly 200 years, and we are grateful to the U.S. Department of Interior for this significant step in the pursuit of justice for our people and ancestors, said Prairie Band Chairman Joseph Rupnik, the fourth great-grandson of Chief Chabanais. The legal title of the land has been transferred to the U.S. government, which holds it in trust for the Prairie Band. The move establishes jurisdictional boundaries and allows the nation to exercise sovereignty, the statement said. The nation is headquartered in Kansas. Other Midwest states, including Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa, already have federally recognized tribal lands. The decision to put portions of the Chabanais Reservation into trust is an important step to returning the land that is rightfully theirs, and I'm so honored to represent the first federally recognized reservation in Illinois, U.S. Representative Lauren Underwood said. The nation is seeking the least disruptive path to recovering the land, according to the statement. All current homeowners will retain the title to their land, and the Prairie Band is still evaluating potential uses for the area. The move to put the land into trust for Prairie Band will hopefully be the first of many steps by the U.S. government to rectify historical injustices across indigenous peoples across the country, according to the statement. From Agribusiness and Stu Ellis's column, Give Us the Farm Bill, Please. On the minds of farmers, the congressional fussing over the farm bill is second only to the start of the planting season. And they are probably happy to be working hard with some green, red, and blue steel and have their hands in the dirt instead of learning that nothing is happening in Washington with the policies that can make or break their livelihood. The 2018 Farm Bill expired September 30th. Congress renewed it until this September 30th, although the economics that formed the basis for its federal policies were based on pre-18 costs and market prices. One GOP senator suggested the farm bill be extended until there was a Republican Congress and a Republican White House. He did not offer any timetable. Today, farmers are planting a crop and will be harvesting it this fall without any assurance about the economic details of a farm program that will impact commodity prices and their family income. Fortunately, the crop insurance program continues from year to year without congressional interference, other than to authorize its existence. That is why Congress knows crop insurance is the top priority of farm organizations and their rank-and-file members who tend to vote on Election Day. The latest timetable for a new farm bill came from Chairman Glenn Thompson of the House Agriculture Committee, who said he would have a proposal for his members to vote upon before Memorial Day. He said the Republican members would like it and the Democratic members would have to make some hard choices to make. In the Senate Ag Committee, Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow said she will have a proposal after she sees the House version. Since she is a Democrat, it will likely be more in line with what the House Democrats want and will include a sufficient food aid program for indigent families. Without that, a farm bill will not pass because the 35 House members who represent rural congressional districts will be outvoted by the 300-plus members who represent urban districts and need to satisfy their constituents. Typically, the farm bill does not end up being a political animal. That has been the general trend over the years, even though the initial legislation originated in the Roosevelt Democratic years. That was the reason most farmers were Democrats until the 1970s, prior to a sea change of agricultural politics. Republican administrations gave farmers the opportunity to do what they wanted, and they took that opportunity with the agri-political rallying cry of freedom to farm. But with all the farm bill regulations and opportunities so long overdue, and no guarantees it will be renewed during the current Congress, farmers just want some certainty and they will figure out how to use it to their advantage. Some are quite creative in that regard, but are masters at caring for their soil, their livestock, their crops, and their family. Most are probably happy that Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is not a member of the House Agriculture Committee. ADM says former CFO Vikram Luthar to resign. Resignation comes amid accounting probe from Bloomberg News, Gerson Freitas Jr., and Tarso Veloso. Archer Daniels Midland Company said former Chief Financial Officer Vikram Luthar, who was placed on leave earlier this year amid an accounting investigation, has agreed to resign effective September 30th. Luthar, who was suspended in January, will be available to assist the company and provide transitional support as needed as a non-executive employee and continue to be paid his base salary, the crop trader said in a filing. The company, which has its North American headquarters and roughly 4,000 employees in Decatur, said in a separate statement that it has initiated a formal selection process to identify the company's next CFO. The departure of Luthar, who spent roughly two decades at the agribusiness giant, was the outcome of a probe into accounting practices that shook the company, that shook the commodity world and wiped out $8.8 billion of ADM's market value in a single day. The move is yet another step by the company to return to business as usual after the scandal. Investigations by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and Department of Justice center around transactions between the nutrition business and other segments. After ADM's own internal probe, the company restated some inter-segment results for the past few years. Luthar held a key position at the troubled unit for more than 2 years before being named ADM CFO in 22. The storied agricultural commodities trader, which historically dubbed itself the supermarket to the world, has spent billions to grow its nutrition unit, the business that makes pet food and veggie burgers. That included $3 billion to acquire Wild Flavors GmbH and another $1.8 billion to take over animal feed maker Neovia, the company's largest ever deals. But that bet has largely failed to live up to expectations, due in part to faltering demand for plant-based ingredients and animal feed. Luthar will receive $743,419 as a cash performance incentive award for 23, and the shares earned for his 21 performance share unit award, the company said in a filing. ADM previously said compensation packages awarded to other executives that were closely tied to the performance of the nutrition division still stand. Ismael Roig has served as an interim CFO since ADM put Luthar on leave. Now from Tony Reed in Decatur, 17-year-old faces attempted murder charge. 17-year-old Malachi J. Blaylock is quoted as telling cops someone sent him a picture of his home and threatened to target it with gunfire, so he rode with an accomplice to the sender's house and they sprayed bullets at the person fired from stolen guns. Blaylock said he saw the person on the porch and fired approximately 7 rounds in the direction of that person, said Decatur Police Department officer Zachary Harding, who signed the affidavit. Blaylock said his 17-year-old accomplice fired approximately 10 rounds at the person. Blaylock said he stole both of the handguns in Mount Auburn from a vehicle. Harding said the gunfire dates to the afternoon of March 19th, and both Blaylock and his accomplice were arrested the same day when police, with the help of eyewitnesses and the keen nose of a police dog, tracked down the teen gunman after they had fled from a stolen GMC Yukon sport utility vehicle used in the shooting. The affidavit does not list anyone being injured by the fusillade of bullets, but said both a house and a car were shot up in the 600 block of South Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. Blaylock, whose case was previously transferred to adult court, is quoted as telling police the intention of the shooting was to kill the person who was shot at. Blaylock appeared Monday in Macon County Circuit Court, where he was arraigned on a charge of attempted murder. He was also arraigned on 3 further charges alleging the aggravated discharge of a gun, 2 counts of possession of a stolen firearm, 2 counts of unlawful possession of a handgun by someone under 18, the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon, and aiding and abetting a possession of a stolen vehicle. The accomplice will face similar charges, and his case is expected to be transferred to adult court soon. Both defendants remain in juvenile detention after being denied pretrial release. A judge ruled they both posed too great a danger to the public to be freed from custody. Harding said the suspects were found at a home in the 700 block of East Condit Street. The accomplice and Malachi Blaylock both have been known to frequent the East Condit address. This is known due to the frequent police contact at this residence when they have been present. A search of the address authorized by a warrant revealed two 9mm handguns that checked out to be stolen, along with a credit card belonging to the owner of the GMC Yukon. The vehicle had been stolen from the parking lot of Decatur Memorial Hospital. And now from the Nation and World page. Digest. Justices appear to side with Starbucks in case. The U.S. Supreme Court appeared to side Tuesday with Starbucks in a case that could make it harder for the federal government to seek injunctions when it suspects a company of interfering in unionization campaigns. Justices noted during an oral argument that Congress requires the National Labor Relations Board to seek such injunctions in federal court and said that that gives the courts the duty to consider several factors, including whether the board would be successful in its case against a company. The NLRB says the National Labor Relations Act allows courts to grant temporary injunctions if it finds a request just and proper, doesn't require it to prove other factors, and was intended to limit the court's role. The case began in 22 when Starbucks fired seven workers who were trying to unionize their Tennessee store. The NLRB obtained a court order forcing the company to rehire the workers during proceedings in the case. Moscow court keeps U.S. journalist in jail. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershovitz will remain jailed on espionage charges after a Moscow court rejected his appeal Tuesday that sought to end his pretrial detention. The 32-year-old U.S. citizen was detained in late March 23 while on a reporting trip and has spent over a year in jail, with authorities routinely extending his time between bars and rejecting his appeals. Last month, his pretrial detention was continued yet again until June 30th in a ruling that he and his lawyers challenged. A Moscow appellate court rejected it Tuesday. Gershovitz's arrest rattled journalists in Russia, where authorities have not detailed what, if any, evidence they have to support the espionage charges. He and his employer deny the allegations, and the U.S. government declared him to be wrongfully detained. Briefly, non-compete agreements. U.S. companies would no longer be able to bar employees from taking jobs with competitors under a rule the Federal Trade Commission approved Tuesday, though the rule is sure to be challenged in court. Migrants. Five people, including a child, died while trying to cross the English Channel from France to the UK, French authorities said Tuesday, hours after the British government approved a migrant bill to deport some of those who entered the country illegally to Rwanda. Diplomacy. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken headed to China on Tuesday for 3 days of talks with senior Chinese officials in Shanghai and Beijing, as U.S.-China ties are at a critical point over global disputes. Baltimore. Officials in Baltimore plan to open a deeper channel for commercial ships to access the city's port starting Thursday, a significant step toward reopening the major shipping hub after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed last month. Layoffs. Jeep maker Stellantis plans to lay off an unspecified number of workers at its U.S. factories to deal with a rapidly changing global auto market, the company said Tuesday. Cyber attack. UnitedHealth said Monday files with personal information that could cover a substantial portion of people in America may have been taken in the cyber attack earlier this year on its Change Healthcare business. In our food section today, we have spring recipes for seared scallop salad with snap peas and radishes, roasted shrimp, asparagus with yogurt dressing, chicken salad with romaine and tahini herb dressing, creamy white bean soup with herb oil and crispy capers. For complete recipes, see the print edition in the food section. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, April 24th. Please stay tuned.